Okay, this is a recording, which I'm making at the University of Washington on 19th February 77. This is a recording of the original recording made of a talk given by Frank Drake on Project Ozma at a meeting, a symposium on radio astronomy held at Colgate University in April 1960, while Project Ozma actually was going on at Green Bank. And this was sponsored by the New York State section of the American Physical Society. He is introduced by Burke, and then there are questions following. The questions were not published in the published account of this talk, which is quite accurate, in Physics Today, Volume 14, page 40, April 1961.
Mr. Brock, would like to thank Professor Cohen, and we'll pass on to the next paper, which will be by Dr. Drake of the National Radio Observatory. I don't have the exact title, but it has something to do with a project named Ozma.
I think I'm here to provide the comic relief to this shindig. The question as to whether there is intelligent life elsewhere in space has long fascinated people, but has been properly left to the science fiction writers and other non-scientific groups, simply because our technology was not capable of detecting any reasonable manifestation that could be expected from other civilized communities in space. In recent years, however, our astrophysical knowledge of the universe and our technology has advanced to the state where these questions can no longer be ignored by the scientists. I'd like to tell you briefly what the present astrophysical picture of the situation is, followed by some anthropomorphic arguments which help us in our search, and finally a brief description of the technology that one might apply to this problem. Astronomical results of recent years have shown that stars are being formed continuously in our galaxy, and apparently this has been going on since the very beginning of the galaxy, at which time the galaxy consisted almost entirely of pure hydrogen. As the stars have been born, lived out their lives, and died, they have enriched the interstellar medium, the hydrogen, with heavier elements, so that the stars that were born and are being born later in the life of the galaxy have in their material heavy elements from which solid bodies such as the planets can be formed. The Sun is one of these younger stars, being some 5 billion years old, as contrasted with the overall age of the galaxy of some 25 billion years. Virtually all the stars in the region of the Sun are younger stars containing the enriched material with heavy elements from which solid bodies can be formed. And of the many stars in the vicinity of the Sun, the Sun is probably one of the younger members. This tells us that in our vicinity there are many stars which were born from material which had in it the constituents from which planets can be made. Now, will planets be made? And this is one of the big changes that has been brought about in our thinking. During the war and in the post-war years, the theories of von Weizsäcker and Kuiper regarding the origin of the solar system have been quite successful and now are quite popular. They are probably not correct in detail, but at least in their broad general form are correct. These theories solve the problem which has always plagued the problem of the formation of the solar system, that is, the problem of angular momentum in a condensing gas cloud. They solve this problem by dumping the angular momentum into a second body or bodies that orbit around the primary star formed in the stellar formation process. So that von Weizsäcker and Kuiper say that through magnetohydrodynamic action or viscosity effects, the angular momentum of a condensing star is transmitted to a second body or bodies. Now, is there observational evidence for this? And in fact, there is a great deal of observational evidence for this. One piece, of course, is the existence of our solar system, where we do in fact find 98% of the angular momentum in the planets themselves. Of course, this is not a convincing argument because there's been a great deal of observational selection made here. However, when we look out in the sky, we find that 40% of the stars occur as binary systems, indicating that probably the dominant way in which angular momentum is dumped is to put it into a second star. It is also very consistent with this whole theory that the mean separation of binary stars is 20 astronomical units, 20 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun, and this is about the mean distance to the major planets of our solar system, so that it would appear that the difference between our solar system and the binary stars is only a very minor one, something that happened as the second body was being formed, which caused many small bodies to be formed rather than one large one. We have, in fact, observed many very light or companions of small mass surrounding nearby stars. The smallest one we know of at present is the companion of the star 61 Cygni, which has a mass of 1/100th the mass of the Sun. And this is the limit to which we can detect such stars of such small mass. Jupiter, by the way, has a mass of 1/1000th the mass of the Sun. And so there is evidence here of a continuous gradation in the second bodies that are formed from objects of stellar mass down through objects of planetary mass. 60% of the stars are alone in space, and so we would conclude that possibly 60% of the stars carry planetary systems with them. And it is of interest further to note that all the stars that are similar to the Sun have slow rotation. They have been very successful in dumping their angular momentum. Struve has proposed long ago that this slow rotation is evidence of planetary systems surrounding these stars, and although these planets have never been observed, Struve states flatly that he thinks that the slow rotation, from which one concludes there are planetary systems surrounding these stars, is one of the most certain facts in astronomy. Astronomers are like that. So our best evidence would suggest that there is a very large number of planetary systems in our galaxy, possibly some 50% of the stars have them. Well, given a planetary system, will there be life on it? Now let's assume we have a planet that is at a temperature appropriate to life, and I will come back to that in a few minutes. Some years ago, there was a very important experiment performed by Stanley Miller at the University of Chicago. Miller made an imitation of what the early Earth's atmosphere was thought to be. This imitation consisted of ammonia, methane, hydrogen, and water, a reducing atmosphere quite different from what we have today. He took this atmosphere and passed through it electrical discharges simulating lightning. After several days, he analyzed the contents of this jar of stuff and found in it, to everyone's amazement, that very large organic molecules had been built by this process. Such molecules as acetic acid were formed, and in particular, amino acids were formed in the jar, including the first amino acid glycine and alanine. The amino acids, of course, are the basic constituents of the protein material, which is the basic building block of life. So that Miller indeed showed that the basic building blocks of living forms could be formed spontaneously in the early terrestrial atmosphere. Later, this experiment was done by Calvin in a slightly different way, using radiation from atomic reactor, with the same result. In very recent months, Calvin has done another remarkable experiment. He has analyzed chemically the constituents of the Callaway County meteorite, which fell in Kentucky some years ago. And he found in this meteorite, using the very sensitive methods that have been developed by the organic chemists, he has found in there fragments of nucleoproteins, ribonucleic acid, and so forth. And these nucleoproteins are, of course, the genetic material, which is the blueprint of living things. So that we have evidence that the genetic material is arriving from space in meteorites, and that the protein material, at least its basic constituents, could arise spontaneously in the early terrestrial atmosphere. We end up with an overall picture in which, on our Earth in the early stages, organic materials, the amino acids, the proteins, were slowly built up in the oceans until there was a great organic soup from which life eventually emerged, and then the process of natural selection eventually led, after some 5 billion years of this chemical and biological evolution, to our present civilization. There are two points that are important that evolve from this discussion. One, it takes at least 5 billion years to provide an intelligent life form. This means that the radiation from the star about which a plant orbits must stay nearly constant in intensity for some 5 billion years. This requirement lets out many stars as possibilities for abodes of intelligent life, because many stars are known not to have lives at constant intensity of as long as 5 billion years. We also know from biochemistry that the temperature on a life-bearing planet must be in a fairly restricted range. And this range can be defined roughly as a range within which water is a liquid. At much higher temperatures than the boiling point of water, all biochemical reactions become destructive. At much lower temperatures, the biochemical reactions become too slow. Now, to get on to the statistics of intelligent communities. And here the significant fact is that the development of technological prowess on Earth has occupied a very short time. Something like 100 years is all that's required for a civilization to go from no knowledge of radio to complete mastery of radio technique. This is long. This is long on the time scale of a man's life, but it's very short on the cosmic time scale. In fact, it is about 10 to minus 7th the age of the galaxy. So if we look at this on the cosmic time scale, which is what counts here, and plot the technical prowess of a civilization versus time. We see that on a planet there's no technical prowess for a long period of time, at which time it shoots up practically vertically. Eventually it must slope over and approach an asymptote, which was probably what can be called very roughly knowledge of all the laws of physics. At some point in this growth, a civilization passes a technical level at which it can communicate with other similar civilizations over interstellar distances, and the Earth is just past this point. Now, because of the continuous formation of stars, there should be a continuous evolution and development of intelligent systems, and we should find intelligent systems, or we should find life forms on planets scattered roughly uniformly along this axis. This means that there will be very many civilizations more advanced than our own, very many less advanced, and only a few in our present transition stage. The result of this is that we will expect most intelligent civilizations in space to be more advanced than ourselves. And the incidence of intelligent civilizations in space will depend not only on the number of planets in space, but the area under this curve. Now, there's an important point here which has been stressed by Bracewell, and that is that here we are assuming great longevity for an intelligent civilization. And we must realize that about this point, we're passing another point, and that is the point at which we're capable of destroying ourselves also. And there is this possibility that intelligent civilizations, in some cases very quickly, in some cases later, destroy themselves. In which case, this curve suddenly drops back to zero. And the area under the curve becomes very small. This means the total incidence of intelligent civilizations in space will be very small. So, this question of how many civilizations in space depends not only on the question of how many planets there are, but on another very important question, and that is there intelligent life on Earth? Let us assume there is, in which case there are intelligent communities in space, and we ask, how can we detect them? Well, we will be looking for communications where the information is being transferred over long distances, and this implies narrow band transmissions. At present, our only narrowband detectors are in the radio range, and so we are restricted to this part of the electromagnetic spectrum. Knowing that, we have to ask ourselves one other question, and that is our technology capable of making such detections? And there's only time enough to say there is. What can we say about the frequencies to use in this radio search? There are three hypotheses, which I'll put up. There's hardly time to do it. The first is that we should search for radiation that other civilizations are using for their own purposes. In this case, the only useful frequencies will be those at which the natural impediments to transmission are minimum. Of course, we are assuming here that they have very advanced technology, which, as we saw, could be the case. In which case, we've heard all about this now several times in the last few days, frequencies above 1,000 megacycles are the ones to use. This doesn't help very much, of course. It leaves a lot of bandwidth. To improve the situation, we can use an argument that was presented by Morrison and Cocconi from Cornell. And they propose that other civilizations attempt to get into contact with us through a feeling of brotherly love or something, or to join, get us as members in the Galactic Physical Society. In which case, these civilizations would attempt to signal us on the frequency at which an emerging civilization first uses high-sensitivity radio telescopes with narrow bandwidths. This frequency is the 21-centimeter frequency, is obvious from what's been said the last 2 days. So, this is a second hypothesis, which says we should use 1420, which of course agrees with the first hypothesis. There's a third hypothesis, which is more economical and probably more reasonable, and that is that other civilizations search the universe for abodes of life, and when they have found one, they send back a message to these people. Again, 1420 is probably the reasonable frequency. So, this frequency has been chosen, and on the basis of all this, on this scientific basis, at Green Bank we've set up a project which attempts to make, is designed to detect such transmissions if they exist. Now, I have a second slide. This is a block diagram of the radiometer that's been built for this purpose. It uses two feed horns, which are alongside each other at the focus, and we switch between them so as to get two beams, one of which is pointed on the star, the other stays alongside the star in question. The effect of this is to allow us to distinguish true radiation from the star from terrestrial interference which may creep into sight. The switching also gives us a Dickey radiometer, in effect. We are using very narrow bandwidths, requiring us to use a very stable local oscillator. In fact, we use a quartz crystal oscillator in an oven with a 9-hour time constant through a phase lock. It is then a standard superhet with four conversions to bring us down to a very low frequency so that we can detect very narrow bandwidths of the order of 100 cycles per second. We then have two bands, one of which is narrow, one of which is wide, and we difference the outputs from these two bands, and this allows us to eliminate wideband noise and detect only narrowband transmissions, which are what we are looking for. We have a high-sensitivity device, a parametric amplifier. This is essential to the argument. This search is now in progress at Green Bank. We are looking at four stars, Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, which are the nearest twins to the Sun, and two other stars, Wolf 359 and WX Ursae Majoris, as control stars. I think you will see from this that the scientific basis for this experiment is sound, the technological basis is sound. What we don't know is what the probabilities of success are. They're obviously quite low, and we cannot expect early success. So we have a sound project, but what is required is the use of very expensive equipment and a great deal of time. Whether the goal, which is the detection of intelligent life, justifies this effort is a question of opinion, and there are certainly people who do not feel that it justifies opinion. Those who do justifies the experiment. Those who do feel that the goal justifies the great amount of effort that is required will be carrying on this research, and there's a good possibility that sometime in the future, and we don't know how long that will be, maybe 100 years, it may be next week, this search will be successful.
there any questions on Dr. Gregg's talk?
What about transit time from these places?
Of course, the nearest solar type stars are about 11 light years away, which means any signal we get has been traveling through space for 11 light years. On this two-way communication business, this idea that they search for transmissions, when they get one, they send something back, this puts us in trouble because, of course, our first strong radio emissions from Earth, the ones that might be detected, probably started out in the early 1930s. A star such as Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani have had time to detect us and send back something. However, if the nearest intelligent community is 50 light years away, we cannot expect an answer until the year 2030, at which time a tremendous booming signal may come in and surprise everyone.
In the last 20 years, we've been sending out an awful lot of electromagnetic noise. Do you think somebody may have picked that up?
I think this is a good possibility that an advanced technology who was seriously interested in this problem could already know of our existence through the radiations we have emitted in space in the last 20 years or so. Well, provided they build a large enough antenna.
No, it's over 20 years.
Oh, yes.
Well, if you took one of the U.S. major radar projects and imagined it out on one of these stars, can you pick it up?
Yes, this is the basis of this statement that our existing technology is adequate. If we put the Millstone radar on Tau Ceti, and we had a major receiver of the type we've heard for the last 2 days, and a fairly large antenna, say 140 foot or something, we could detect that radar.
You're assuming that you know the pattern of the signal and when it should come in?
No, we only assume that we will tune to the correct frequency and have about the right bandwidth. This is, I think this is a fact that is fairly extraordinary and just reflects the very great technological advance we've had. This is with a 10 cycle per second bandwidth and 1 megawatt radiated power into an 85 foot antenna. This is what Millstone uses, yes. But a little less, but this is coming up, but this is order of magnitude, very close. Okay, 10 cycles is actually wider than what they use. They use just actually tenths of a cycle per second in the bandwidth.
What is the reference for the organic material in the meteorite?
This is a paper which has not been published in the regular journals. It was presented at the International Conference on Space at Nice in January. And I don't know where Calvin intends publishing. Maybe it's in the proceedings of that conference.
Are you merely detecting or are you sending?
We are not sending. Obviously, our astronomical knowledge is not good enough yet to pick out good targets to send at. I mean, if we were to send out many beams in hopes of getting one star, a life on it would cost far more than anyone can afford. In any case, I don't think anyone would support one beam out in space at the present time.
Well, what type of message are you looking for? Would it be a formula or?
The message, we have to be very open-minded about this. Almost anything will do. You see, anything that's not noise is sufficient to prove an intelligent transmission. It could be just a simple series of pulses, it could be numbers, or it could, if it's something they're using for their own purposes, it could be radar or television or who knows what.
There are many transmissions that you can manufacture here that would slip through your net. For instance, something which goes over 1 megacycle at a kilocycle rate. So you should have some kind of correlator rather than just a wideband, narrowband comparison.
There are many possibilities, things that could happen, as you say, to confuse us. But we don't have the money now to build the type of equipment that's really required to do this, which is a narrow, a multi-channel receiver with ways of sorting out all these various possibilities.
Thank you.
Dr. Mike mentioned money. Might not a taxpayer know that one of these stars has a negative radial velocity and is approaching the Earth and asked you to wait until this was nearer?
Well, there is an answer to that. In both cases, the stars have large proper motions, too, which means they're not on a collision course with Earth. And therefore, they probably will not be much nearer for several million years than they are now.
One more question?
As the argument that you went through that proves that this is at least worthwhile trying, doesn't that argument tend to lend weight to the idea that there's something in the flying saucers?
There was an argument I didn't have time to present, and that is, see, there's an incorrect conclusion one can reach, and that is that a civilization with great technical prowess should stand as a beacon in the sky, because they can radiate all kinds of power and so forth, and send spaceships and all the rest, and we should expect these spaceships, which we don't see. And the argument is this, that economics still rules the day, no matter how advanced a civilization is. And they will do only what is necessary. They will do only what is necessary to fulfill their self-assigned purposes, whatever those might be. Now, the only reason one wants to travel in space is to get information. There is nothing that is worth the expense of carrying it across space. No, not gold or anything else. It's far easier to get it at home. So the only thing that's worth carrying across space is communication. And by far the cheapest way to carry information across space is electromagnetic radiation. So this is where we should look for space travelers in form of electromagnetic waves.
Well, isn't the distance to the nearest star such that under reasonable lifespans, it's almost, it would be physically impossible, even with velocities of moving light?
Well, it's 4 light years to the nearest star. One might do it.
Suppose you did with a tenth.
That's 40 years, but one can foresee breeding people on this thing as you go along. And there are ways out of this. It's not a pleasant or economical way of doing things.
I think that I'd like to thank Dr. Drake, and on behalf of radio astronomers, I would like to serve warning on him that if Congress does appropriate the money for him to transmit, at 1420 megacycles, then you will receive something much more concrete than electromagnetic radiation.